This is The Big Something, in-depth conversation on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region. I'm Jake Brownell. On today's show, we hear from the soon-to-be newest member of the Colorado State Supreme Court, Richard Gabriel.
When you apply the rule of law equally and impartially to everyone, you get equal justice and you get a fair result.
We bring you an interview with artist Rodney Wood about Trinidad's art car parade, the Articade.
It is just fun to drive these things. You do not blend. It's so weird now when I drive my regular car, I'm like bummed no one's looking at me.
Elliot Gray Fisher of Austin-based Arcos Dance discusses The Warriors, a Love Story, a multimedia performance coming to Colorado Springs next weekend.
We're interested in using the tools that we have today to create an art form that resembles what people have seen in the past, but is also saying something new.
And we check in with members of Hear Hear's National Slam Poetry Team.
You say the things that people are afraid to say. You call yourself out on what you have done. You write about it, then you tell people about it.
All that today on The Big Something. The Colorado Supreme Court is about to get a new judge. Richard Gabriel will soon be sworn in as Colorado's next state Supreme Court justice. He's leaving his seat on the Colorado Court of Appeals. He received his undergrad degree at Yale and went to the University of Pennsylvania School of Law. He recently spoke with State House reporter Benta Berkland about his view of politics in the judicial process, why he became a lawyer, and some of his significant cases.
Judge Gabriel, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You'll be joining the state Supreme Court in September. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Did you ever have that as a goal or something you'd hope to achieve throughout your career?
Well, not growing up. I grew up on Long Island to a working class family, and never in a million years would I have thought I would have ended up from there to here. My father worked behind a deli counter in supermarkets. My mom was a self-described housewife. There were no lawyers in the family. I was a driven kid and motivated. We struggled in my family for money. It was always a difficult issue, so I wanted to create a better life. My parents wanted me to have a better life than they did. Somewhere along the line, I thought, you know, being a lawyer would be a successful, good thing to do.
When the governor announced your appointment, he talked about your strengths in the business community and some of the cases you've worked on. Could you highlight some of that aspect of your background?
Sure. When I first got out of law school, I worked for a federal judge in Baltimore. Then I joined a large firm in New York where I did basic commercial and business litigation. I then joined the firm that was Holm Robertson Owen, it's now Brian Cave, here, where again I did business litigation and intellectual property litigation.
I understand you represented Michael Jackson. Talk about that case.
Yeah, that's true. Michael was sued in Denver in 1992 by a woman from Denver for copyright infringement. And the case involved a song called Dangerous. The woman had a song called Dangerous. And my firm got retained to represent Mr. Jackson. That was a particular pleasure for me to work on that case. I happen to be a professional trumpet player, and I've been playing the trumpet for 44 years, so to get to work on a music copyright case was fascinating for me, particular one of that profile. We tried the case in February of 1994 and did win the case.
Did you personally meet Mr. Jackson?
We met Michael twice, once at his deposition and once right around the trial time. He was a tremendous witness, and is a kind of person, I think this might surprise people, you realized immediately that this was a genius. You're in the presence of someone who is a musical genius.
Now you're serving on the Court of Appeals. What are some of the big challenges there, and what have you enjoyed about this position?
What I've most enjoyed about being on this court is the collegiality of this court. Anyone who knows anything about the law knows it's not always the case in courts where judges are collegial. We work together. We work very hard in this court. Our docket is very high. We decided as a court something on the order of 2,200 cases last year. There's not a whole lot of breaks for us as the first-level appellate court and frequently the court of last resort, seeing all manner of every kind of interesting case you can imagine.
For the listener, can you just list off a few?
Every kind of crime, with the exception of death penalty cases, which go directly to the Supreme Court, we see. The ones I remember, I suppose, are the hardest ones. I had a very difficult case involving rent controls in Aspen. It was difficult because of the procedural setting in the case. I had a case involving a young man in El Paso County who, because of his religious faith, could not have a blood transfusion, and he was diagnosed with leukemia. And the question presented was, can a mature minor make that decision to refuse life-saving treatment?
What did you guys decide?
In that case, we ultimately decided that the trial court did not have jurisdiction to decide the issue. It was a procedural thicket.
How many hours a week would you say you work?
My wife will probably say I short-circuit this, but I work very hard. I would guess around 70 to 80 hours. I take work home pretty much every day and every weekend. The volume of reading is extreme here.
Is it hard when you are dealing with such, you know, sometimes life and death and really emotional, tough cases to separate that when you leave the office?
No, I think you have to learn how to separate that out. We have to take an objective eye on these cases. It's also enjoyable, frankly. It's the challenging cases that drive me, which frankly is one reason I decided to apply for a position on the Supreme Court.
A nonpartisan judicial nominating committee comes up with three final candidates, and you were one of those three, and the governor chose you. What was that process like?
I'm a big fan of our merit selection system in Colorado. The way it works is you fill out a fairly lengthy application that goes to this nominating commission that's nonpartisan. They work exceptionally hard based on my experience. They call references. They call your opponents in cases if you're a trial lawyer. In my case, they call litigants who appeared in front of me. And the majority of the commission are non-lawyers. And I frankly find the non-lawyers' questions to sometimes be much more interesting and difficult than the lawyer questions. They ask questions about what was the biggest mistake that you've ever made and how did you deal with it. Then the governor does an extensive due diligence process, which again is fascinating to watch close at hand to see how hard they work. They solicit comments from lawyers all over the state. Both of the other nominees here were very good friends of mine, and they are superb. And to be selected, I suppose, there's a little bit of luck in that too, given these quality of people.
You are a registered Democrat. How are you able to separate out politics from your job?
It's not an issue at all. My approach to any case is to figure out what the rule of law is or the rules of law that apply, and to try to apply those rules to the facts presented in the narrowest possible way consistent with doing justice. My goal really is to get it right and to do the best I can.
Do you think that there is a change in tenor around the country when it comes to judges? I know judges are typically seen as nonpartisan and separate from politics, but then when we have the U.S. Supreme Court, and obviously some of those tough decisions are political in nature.
There are two different ways to look at that. First, in terms of the U.S. Supreme Court, there's a perception that their cases are frequently political and 5-4 decisions. Historically, that's not actually the case if you looked at their complete docket. The highly sensitive social issues tend to get a lot of the press, and those are sometimes, or maybe even frequently, 5-4 decisions. But many times the court decides unanimously. So I think there may be a misperception based on the nature of those cases. The other thing that affects politics or the view of politics in our system is the way we select judges. Colorado is a merit selection state. In other jurisdictions, they elect judges in partisan elections. I've got to be careful talking about making political statements, but that creates certain issues, like judges raising money to campaign in a partisan election where perhaps they run as a member of a certain party. As a criminal defendant, you're sitting in a courtroom where a judge has run on the grounds, I'm going to be very hard on criminal defendants, and you're a criminal defendant, that at least raises some concerns.
To end on a philosophical question, do you think there's a difference between justice and fairness, and how do you equate those two?
Justice and fairness go hand in hand, in my view. I suppose you can view justice narrowly as applying rules of law, and sometimes that comes out with a result that doesn't strike someone as fair, but I suppose the flip side of that is we have to apply rules of law fairly and partially to all, and that, I think, is what results in equal justice. So to me, I have trouble separating out the two. I think when you apply the rule of law equally and impartially to everyone, you get equal justice and you get a fair result. Now, is the law perfect or are judges perfect? No. We're human beings and we do the best that we can.
Thanks. That was Judge Richard Gabriel. He will become Colorado's newest Supreme Court justice.
It's a pleasure to be here with you.
I'm Benta Berkland in Denver.
Judge Gabriel is taking a seat being vacated by Justice Gregory Hobbs. In addition to being a judge, Hobbs is also a water advocate and poet. KRCC's Andrea Chalfin spoke with Hobbs in 2012 and asked him to read a few of his poems and talk about his perspective of the sacred importance of water.
Lord, grant us to receive your waters, not without question. For to question is one of the many ways we may understand how At this bend of this river, we may find ourselves reflecting the many sources of your shining habitat. In tumult, we arrive, swirl, and circulate. We are capable of creation because you abide in us and we in you. Of all your creations, we are mingled of your flowing grace, creature, vessel, punch, and pouring spout. We are here, Lord. Receive us, patience, who would practice patience, not without answer, O Lord. For in the twist of your stirring stick, we feel the resolution of your resolve. You hold us dear, and we are willing, capable, thankful. So I've been writing poetry really since high school, and water poetry in particular is a passion, because I don't think you can travel anywhere in the West without seeing that our most valuable spiritual asset is actually flowing water. Whatever water moves through or touches, it blesses. And so there's always been this spiritual and origin concept. Every people of every age has put water and life in a synonymous, you know, the breath of God moves across the waters, as described in the Hebrew Bible. And then the Hopis believe that their ancestors came up a reed out of the lake in the center of the earth into this glittering world, as they would call it, the surface world. 75% of us is water, you know, and sometimes I think that water invented us to carry itself around in. We are a water vessel, you know, all life is that. And we realize living here in Colorado how important that is, because we value recreation and fishing, and we have water rights now for these kind of uses. Marshalling water and learning how to govern and sharing water in community is the essence of survival in the arid lands, and we know from the early drought of the 21st century how dry it can get. O blessed rain, fall and renew the bearded purple iris, all the single, each and every pollen, unconfuse us. We've got to share our water. Remember, we're the watershed. When we became the Colorado Territory in 1861, we got the headwaters of the Platte, the Arkansas, the Rio Grande, and the Colorado River. I mean, there's no other state like us, the mother of rivers. We have to share it, and that means we have to live on a tight budget internally for our own growth into the future. Water's all about, really, this is about our history and culture. Every one of these ditches anywhere in Colorado has a story to. Why was it developed? Who developed it? What grew up out of it? We all grew up, all these cities grew up out of these farmlands and out of these ditches. So this is the poem, Water's All About. Water's all about our work and play, how we're formed and look. From brow to toe, brain and heart, mountain front and plains afoot. Snow-white caps on winter heads, rolled up sleeves in August bake. Lakes and streams that swell and shrink, that fall and spring are equinox. Gnarly hands and gnarled up knuckles, buckled plates and chisel grooves. From north to south, the hogback hues, the reds, the greens, our faults, our hopes. From east to west, the morning peeps. She plants her feet in columbine. She spreads her mantle on the utes, the canyon rims, the furrow rows. She sets our route, our journey on, her waves and pools, her come along. So the siren call of water is our past, our present, and our future.
That was Justice Gregory Hobbs from a 2012 interview with KRCC's Andrea Chalfin. Hobbs is retiring from the Colorado Supreme Court. This is The Big Something. I'm Jake Brownell. Trinidad, Colorado has been known for many things over the past century. From the site of the Ludlow Massacre to the so-called sex change capital of the world, the tiny town just across the border from New Mexico has history more colorful than most cities. Artist Rodney Wood hopes to keep that tradition alive. Commissioned to create an event that would help Trinidad rebrand itself for the 21st century, Wood created the Articade, a weekend-long art car parade, dance party, and circus in mid-September that now brings in cars from all over the United States. This year's Articade is coming up the weekend of September 12th. When the following interview first aired in 2013, The event was just getting started. Now, says Wood, they're expecting over 78 entries. Here's Wood speaking with KRCC's Noel Black.
How did this thing come about? Was this an idea that you pitched to the town of Trinidad, or is this something that they came to you with?
They came to me because Trinidad's going through a lot of challenges and some of their special events have died. Trinidadio died, and they're just looking for something to put us back on the map, something. So they knew me from years ago, Business of Arts Center, State Fair, all those kinds of things. So Pat Patrick, the head of the tourism board, asked me to come up with something. And the goal was to just to attract people to town. And I said, be careful what you wish for. And I said, I don't want to do anything standard. And I tried thinking about the typical arts and crafts fair, concerts, studio tours, rodeo, whatever. And I've been to a few art car fairs and I loved it. And it's like, my turn. So I pitched that to them and they loved it.
Did you think maybe an avant-garde rodeo was in the offing?
That would have been good. The punk rodeo. I like that idea. Next year.
Conceptual rodeo.
I've always thought that punk music and country western could really do a cool overlap.
So why an art car festival? Is there another art car festival that exists?
It's actually a really big deal elsewhere. Houston's in their 27th or 28th year of art car festivals. They're the granddaddy, grandmother. This year they had 350 vehicles and 300,000 spectators at an art event. I don't care where you are. That's amazing. So that was part of it. Seattle has a big one. Reno, a pretty good-sized one. Minneapolis comes and goes. There's a whole network out there. Pardon, but here we go. There's a lot of puns involved in the art car nation. That's what they call themselves. So they're out there. But they're really kind of centered around certain areas, and Houston's the big one. So having seen the one in 2010, I loved it for a variety of reasons. One, it was just made you feel like a 10-year-old. It's like, oh, look at that. Just, it was kind of this 10-year-old mouth agape awe that goes with it. There's a sense of humor about it. It attracts a wide variety of participants and a wide variety of people liking it. And I'm already seeing that down in Trinidad with the people that are honking their horns when I got something parked out in front. I mean, it's old people, you know, low-income people. So that was the appeal. There's also something really cool about an art event that's not about selling art or selling tickets or the whole marketing commercial aspect of it. Sure, we'd like people to eat down there and check out some of the booths that local artists have, but it's not the goal. The goal is to show their art. I mean, even the art car artists themselves are really more about sharing their art than making money on their art. And so, you know me, I've been around from commercial galleries and museums and nonprofits and all that stuff, and it's the barometer of success is so often the bottom line. It's not with us. And it doesn't seem to be that way anywhere. Example, the cartists, they come to our event because I raise money from sponsorship to pay for their fuel. They turn in their fuel slips and I double it, find them a place to stay, throw a few meals at them. They're not going home with any money. Only a handful of them may have a few things like t-shirts or something to sell, but they're coming to play with art. That's what got me.
Has it inspired anyone in Trinidad to make art cars, or were there already folks doing art cars in Trinidad?
I think we're going to have 45 entries. 15 or more were made in Trinidad now, or in the immediate area. It absolutely did inspire people to do it. Groups, again, people who don't think of themselves as artists, nonprofits, Noah's Ark Animal Shelter. I'm trying to get them in there. This really ugly van. I said, you know, a little paint would be nice. They came up with a great idea. They're covering their van with dog tags. So, and even some of the artists who are, again, have been battling, trying to make a living, whatever, they're having a gas. They're just running with it. They're, you know, I'll talk to the husband or wife of the art car person, they're like, oh, this has got them so fired up again. So it's this great, inspiring community building thing where people are all overlapping and we'll sneaking around trying to see each other's car. And the goal is to make this a signature event that happens every year like Trinidadio did. So we'll start next year with a whole bunch of cars. So it's really cool. Some of them are real temporary where they come apart and they put them back together. Some are commitments. This one woman named Ariella made this outrageously cool glass mosaiced Isuzu Trooper thing. She spent hundreds of hours on it. So it did inspire people. And I think this is just the first year. Seattle, first year, they had 25 vehicles. Next year, they had 125 vehicles. So that will happen.
Trinidad has this really fascinating history. It started off with the coal mines. It's got this incredible labor history around Ludlow. And then Drop City, which was this hippie commune more or less inspired by Buckminster Fuller, geodesic domes with the... And then it became known as the sex change capital of the world when Stanley Biber was there for many years. And then his successor left and shut that down. And I wonder, you know, obviously Trinidad has gone through many identity transformations over the year, but that was a long one. And I wonder what effect did that have on the community? And is this Art Car event a response to the loss of either notoriety or identity that resulted from that?
I think it's a loss of positive thinking as much as anything else. I mean, they've lost a lot of jobs, some notoriety. Their identity has been floating around and trying to find a place to be in this time in which we live, with the loss of all the mine jobs and the hospital situation and schools. There's just a lot of challenges there, economic, social challenges. So I believe it really will have an impact. I'm starting to think it will have a big impact, and one that will last for quite a while, because it, and again, it's about fun and art. So art overlapping. Actually, you mentioned Drop City. I heard rumors of a possible Drop City van out in one of the junk yards. I found it, and it's now at the History Museum.
Really?
It's there.
What does a Drop City van look like?
It's an old bread truck with house-painted, muted colors of peace signs, and one thing says, peace is, and then it's this little mountain range thing underneath it. So it's total hippie, and, you know. I was there. I was a hippie. Graduated in high school in 1969. So it's interesting that even that question, because of the Artocade thing, Drop City gets back in the game. That's really cool. I mean, they love it. Drag it down there. There's no wheels. They may just put it on a trailer and put it in the parade this year, but it's now going to be at the History Museum. Even the state people are like thrilled to have something cool besides, oh, we found the long-lost archive of yet another ranch in Colorado. So they're loving it. It's going to be educational. It'll drag a different kind of tourist and visitor to the museum. So in a way, tricked them into the presence of history through the Drop City thing. So that's really cool. So I think Articade is going to hopefully help this. What we have that Houston and Seattle doesn't have is they have their big events and it's kind of over. Every time I go there, I'll see an art car, though. They're kind of round. Some of them are daily drivers where they did something crazy to their car and they just drive it to work. There's a few in Colorado Springs, a couple.
Do you expect any sort of ad hoc additions?
Yeah, it's going to start happening that way. Because when you drive these around, it is just freaking fun to drive these things. You do not blend. A couple of them that I've got under my wing right now are just this crazy thing. You're driving down the street. And even the completely oblivious can't miss these things. So it's just really fun. It's so weird now when I drive my regular car, I'm like, bummed, no one's looking at me. So I think it will have residual for years. And I think people will like Ariella's mosaic. She's going to start driving it around. I mean, people are going to see it and go, cool, look at that. So
you've been involved in many efforts to leverage the arts to transform either a community sense of place, or to really try to transform the economy of a place. That was true certainly at the Business of Art Center in Manitou, where you were incredibly successful. And here you're involved in such an effort again. And I guess part of me wonders, having watched these kinds of transformations take place as really, you know, from communities that are looking for things to kind of hitch their wagons to, is there a limit to which art can transform places? Have we reached a kind of nadir where maybe it's running out of steam, or do you feel like it has sort of an infinite power?
I think it has an infinite power, but it's a moving target. It's funny, when organizations or events get stuck, it's they get stuck with the success more than the failure. And so they don't evolve, and things have changed. I mean, like, they have, you know, every town has these arts and crafts fairs or these festivals. And when they were new, but now everyone has one. So when you throw out something a little different, I think it revitalizes the spirit of the people participating, but it also shows that creativity is required. I mean, big corporations know this. I mean, whether it's Nike or Ben and Jerry, they get it, that you can't just stay and go back there and go back there and go back there. I mean, that's part of Trinidadio was a great thing, but a lot of the people that were involved really just kind of got burned out and tired. And so it was a loss, and from that loss can come something else instead of, well, let's do another blues festival. Really? So why take that? Because around the country, as an example, there's a lot of arts and crafts fairs that have been around forever or dying, because it's just changed. Things have changed in our culture. So art is supposed to involve some creativity. So in the promoting of events and art events in particular, be creative, have some fun with it, and get out of your own way of, again, the barometers being only one thing. And like this, I really, it sounds like a lot of the motels are getting filled up and there's none left. And it's like, really? In your first year? Wait till next year. So it can have an economic impact, but I think it happens incidentally, not intentionally sometimes. And again, Trinidad, because of its size, they're taking over the town. It's art car town. Houston can't do that. Seattle can't do that. They have a big party and then their art car parade, but we're having events and people are all walking around downtown. They'll be looking at the old building and going, cool, look at that. A big town can't do that. So to answer your question is, I think it's harder and harder, but it takes more and more creativity. And in a small town, you can have a larger impact because of something that will essentially take over the town.
Rodney Wood, thanks so much.
Thanks.
That was KRCC's Noel Black speaking with artist Rodney Wood. Wood is the organizer of Articade, a weekend-long art car festival and parade that will take place this year on September 11th, 12th, and 13th in Trinidad, Colorado. For more information on the event, go to artocade.com. To hear this piece again and for a link, you can head to krcc.org. This is The Big Something. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Big Something, in-depth conversation on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region. I'm Jake Brownell. Next weekend, Austin-based multimedia performance group Arcos Dance will bring their original production, The Warriors, A Love Story, to Colorado Springs. Through an interdisciplinary mix of music, dance, theater, and film, The Warriors, A Love Story explores the love, lives, and legacies of Colorado Springs residents J. Glenn Gray and Ursula Gray. Glenn and Ursula Gray met in Germany in the aftermath of World War II. He was an American soldier from rural Pennsylvania with a PhD in philosophy. She, an accomplished dancer and athlete from the decimated German city of Dresden. After an unlikely courtship and marriage, the two found their way to Colorado Springs, where Glenn was offered a job teaching philosophy at Colorado College. In the decades that followed, the two would go on to make substantial contributions to the local community and national intellectual culture. In particular, Glenn would become known for his book, The Warriors, Reflections on Men in Battle, published in 1959, as well as for his work as an early translator and champion of the 20th century German philosopher, Martin Heidegger. In advance of next weekend's performance, set to take place at Colorado College's Cornerstone Art Center, I spoke with Elliot Gray Fisher, multimedia director of Arcos Dance and the grandson of Glenn and Ursula Gray, about the story of Glenn and Ursula and why it's still relevant today.
J. Glenn Gray grew up in rural Pennsylvania, very humble origins, several children in his family, and he was the only one who went on to college. And there were stories about his intellectual leanings from very early on. He had been told by his parents, apparently, to go out and watch the cows regularly as part of his farm duties, and was always found lying around reading instead, or, you know, not really keeping an eye on the cows because he was had his face in a book, which was very unusual for the family and for the region, really. So this farm boy from the country went on to college, and he ended up going on and getting a master's in German language and literature. But what he discovered in reading all of this German literature was that he delved even further into sort of this the world of the mind, and fell in love really with European culture, with German culture especially, and his studies in literature took him down the path of reading some philosophy, and loved that even more than the literature he'd been reading. So he ended up going on and getting a PhD in philosophy, so he kind of took that path to its logical conclusion, you know. And then he received his doctorate from Columbia, news that he'd received his doctorate in the same mail on the same day as his letter from the president inviting him, drafting him into the war, basically.
So tell me about Ursula Gray, his eventual wife. What was she doing during that time?
So Ursula grew up in Dresden, very different upbringing. She was a city girl and pretty well off, so that she had been encouraged from a young age to pursue the arts in a way that Glenn hadn't. She found a love for dance. She was very physical and loved movement. So she danced with all of these early dance pioneers at the time. Modern dance was just sort of coming about, you know, the Expressionist movement in Germany sort of led to this. I mean, all of these modernist artistic movements were born out of World War I in some cases, out of the turn of the century, and she was in on that movement. She studied with Mary Wigman, who was one of the sort of preeminent figures of modern dance in those early days in Germany. So anyway, she studied dance, and she also trained and was an alternate for the Olympic track team for Germany for the 36 Olympics in Berlin.
And so Glenn is drafted into the war. Ursula, I'm sure, was drawn in various ways. How did they eventually meet?
So they met after the war. They met in Munich. Ursula, survived the bombing of Dresden, February 13th and 14th, into February 15th, 1945, you know, which is a very controversial campaign. She and her sister escaped after having lived through those nights and survived the firebombs and the enormous fires and firestorms that were caused by it, and the strafing by airplanes afterwards, and they escaped to Munich. Glenn had some compelling and horrific experiences in the war that he had witnessed and participated in and was troubled by, and he wanted to do something that would be the antithesis of the destructive work that he had been engaged in during the war. So he came back to Munich as part of the American military government there, the occupying American government that was setting up the university system at the time. They had to denazify it. So Glenn was involved in that, and Ursula found her way after a number of jobs into being a secretary, and then ended up being head secretary of that sort of area. So that's how they met.
So after Glenn and Ursula meet in Munich, what happens next? How do they sort of proceed to build a life together?
So this is the funny story that we ended up using via interview footage that we got from this documentary series that was shot in the 1970s. They met working together, right, in Munich in this educational division, and they weren't allowed to talk to each other at the time.
We were strictly forbidden not to fraternize. Americans and Germans were not supposed to talk to each other. So we didn't talk, but I found one orange on my desk.
It never occurred to me that one shouldn't do this, that this was inappropriate.
And this was the first sign of attraction or getting together.
He says in this interview that he always imagined that he might fall in love with an enemy girl, just for some reason. It was just kind of like this kind of predisposition that he was, at least he was not going to not consider it.
Curiously enough, in my journals, I often felt that I would marry a German girl. It happens in every war that many marriages between former enemies take place.
He expressed his interest to her with this gift of an orange, this mysterious gift. And they went on, and the rules lightened up, as they say in the interview, and they were able to talk to each other and began dating or courting or whatever it was back then, and got married pretty quickly.
My friends, when they heard I married an American, were very angry. They said, "How can you? You are a traitor. How could you? The Americans bombed Dresden, and here you marry an American." And I lost many friends.
She likewise kind of didn't care that he was an American.
I couldn't feel that. I couldn't feel that at all. Glenn was a human being, and so fine and so sensitive and so made no difference what nationality.
So they got married, and they ended up coming back to the U.S. He got a couple job offers, and one of them was at Colorado College. He took the job. They came out sight unseen. I don't think he'd ever really been west of the Mississippi, if I'm right. But they just packed up and they drove out there. And as soon as they got into the area, Ursula was just overjoyed because it looked like the Alps. Here was Pike's Peak. Here were the Rocky Mountains, and it looked familiar to her. And so this was a place where she really fell in love with, and she thought she could spend the rest of her life, and they did.
And so as they went on and built careers, and in particular, as Glenn Gray went on to be a writer and write books of philosophy, they both, if I'm correct, worked to incorporate their experiences in the war into the intellectual work that they did. Could you talk about how that kind of worked itself out in their creative output? And, you know, you can focus on either one.
Well, Glenn is the most obvious one. I think, you know, Ursula's is a little harder to trace, but it's a little subtler, I think. Glenn was haunted by the experiences that he'd had in the war. Going back and starting to teach at Colorado College and going back into the classroom was this refuge, was this way for him to begin to feel like a civilian again and to make that shift, that mental shift. But he also found tons of veterans in his classes because of the GI Bill. So there were lots and lots of veterans that he was teaching. And he found a special bond with them because they had shared the experience of combat, of war. And it was something that occupied his mind a lot. And so his first major project was this book, The Warriors, Reflections on Men in Battle, which was pretty unusual, especially for an American to come out with at the time, because it was pretty honest about war, and it was not jingoistic and didn't paint himself as an American or America generally with an oversimplified brush. It's this very kind of phenomenological approach. So throughout the war, he was writing in a journal, as well as corresponding with people back home and friends in other parts of the war. And he went back over the course of, took him 14 years to write this book. He looked at some of these and tried to turn them into, try to universalize them and try to look at their broader implications. And one of the things that he was interested in, having filled his head with especially the classical Greek philosophers in his doctorate program, was a very broad historical scope, looking at humanity and looking at the documents that have tracked war, what war is, what the experience of war is, its motivations, its effects on society. So he had this very sort of long view, both while he was in the war and then in retrospect as he was writing this book. And this book that was published in 1959 about contemporary warfare is strangely still really relevant today. Probably, unfortunately, still really relevant. In fact, maybe even more relevant, which is bizarre.
And what exactly about it do you think is still relevant? Like, what are some of his major points that he makes in that book that seem to still be resonating with people today?
Well, I think, you know, the interesting thing that he does, like I said, by kind of zooming out and looking at, you know, the experience, the relationships, the sort of moral character of situations that he encountered, those are things that are universal. And yet there's a piece of it that's talking about how technology specifically, I think, has begun changing what war is at the time that he experienced it in the middle of the 20th century. And I think those are the things that have become more relevant. One of the things talking about the way that technology has colored how we do war is images of the enemy. There's a whole chapter on propaganda and sort of the modern propaganda machine, which again has only become far more sophisticated and potent. He talks about the images of the enemy and the indoctrination of soldiers to hate the enemy, you know, to turn people, regular people who in most normal instances wouldn't, you know, just kill someone, to be willing and eager to kill members of this group that are being fought. So, you know, I think that's one of the things that we're especially interested in is the way that his words continue to echo in our time. And he was really prescient.
And to that end, so just tell me a little bit about what this performance is going to be, the performance that's set to take place at Colorado College, and why Arcos, why you felt that this story would be well suited to the kind of multimedia performances that you all do?
Well, it's interesting because Arcos started doing this kind of work just a few years ago. We just formed, and my background is with video and music and theater. And my collaborators, Curtis Ullman and Erica Jean Frido, who's my wife, are dancers and choreographers. And we started working together and trying to see how we could combine all of our art forms really dynamically in the 21st century, right? This is an idea that's been around since Wagner, talking about the Gesamtkunstwerk, you know, this total artwork that could combine everything. And for him, it's opera, right? You can have these beautiful painted sets or sort of the visual arts are incorporated, art and architecture into the settings. There's music, there's theater, there's, you know, there's all of these things. And so we're 100 or so years past the invention of film, and art and technology sort of have merged in interesting ways. And we're interested in using the tools that we have today to create an art form that resembles what people have seen in the past, but is also saying something new. So it was interesting. What makes it a perfect story to tell is that Glenn and Ursula, their lives and their work and their loves combine many of the things that we want to combine, right? So there's dance. There are things that we can tell in dance that we can't tell with text. And yet there's also Glenn, who is a man of words and a man of ideas. And we can also have that. You know, what if we combine philosophy and dance and video and narrative theatrical elements? In my view, these two people were very ordinary people in a lot of ways, and yet they were extraordinary. I like that idea, regular people doing extraordinary things. And I like to celebrate that legacy in this production.
That was my conversation with Elliot Gray Fisher, multimedia director of Arcos Dance. Arcos will be performing their multimedia dance theater production, The Warriors, A Love Story, at Colorado College's Cornerstone Arts Center on Friday, September 4th and Saturday, September 5th at 7:30 p.m. on both nights. The performance is free and open to the public. For more information or to hear that interview again, head to krcc.org. This is The Big Something. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Big Something, in-depth conversation on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region. I'm Jake Brownell. Hear Hear is an organization in the Pikes Peak region that brings people together to celebrate the art of performance poetry. At monthly open mics and slam competitions, Hear Hear provides a space where poets can share their work and hone their skills as writers and performers. This summer, Hear Hear sent several poets to the National Poetry Slam in Oakland. Big Something intern Charlie Neves spoke with the team members prior to their trip.
For me, writing in general, when I was writing poems for the page, and especially when I was writing them for the stage, it's always been about survival. It's always been about survival and about trying to take these words and these thoughts that otherwise would have just gone extinct in my mind, and maybe I would have gone with them. There were points in my life where I thought I would. It is in being able to speak and be accepted and heard and admired for this skill that I've worked so hard at that I am able to keep being here. And what makes me feel like I'm home.
Spoken word poetry is an art form that begs to be heard and challenged. The meaning of this poetry exists in the space where written word meets performance art. Since 2011, the Hear Hear organization in the Pikes Peak region has provided a space for this art form. Co-founded by Luke Sissel and Susan Pfeiffer, Hear Hear fosters community through local open mics, workshops, and poetry slams. Hear Hear states that their mission is to listen, write, and share. Recently, Hear sent a team of 5 poets to the 15th annual National Poetry Slam in Oakland, California. Before the event, these poets discussed their own ambitions, what slam poetry has the potential of achieving, and why this increasingly popular, fluid art form matters.
All right, I'm Cam Eckmeyer. I don't have a stage name.
Nico Wilkinson. I'm a spoken word poet, part of the Hear 2015 Slam team.
I go by the name of Bees J, which is actually Jamar Beasley. So, not that hard.
My name is Mallory Everhart. I'm a competitive performance poet representing Hear at the National Poetry Slam in Oakland, California.
I'm Andrew. Andrew Ziegler. I have people. Yeah, we'll just leave it at that.
I want to be a jazz band to say something, do something, change something, change everything, to never finish this work in progress.
There's a lot of people that don't have a voice, and they don't know where to go to get a voice. Poetry is one of those major outlets that allows you to speak your feelings and emotions and not feel scared to let someone know how you feel and be accepted for it. And there's people that are out there that are like, I thought I was alone. I didn't think anyone else felt that way.
Poetry has always been a service. Poets have always been servants to a community. If you look at the griots in Africa, and you look at the bards in Europe, you know, in history, poetry has always been it's always been considered a necessity, enough so that there is a position for it. And you can see that when people say, I'm hurting and I need a poem. And then you give them a poem that you can just, you have it in your head. You are the library. I would say it's a gift, but it isn't a gift. It's what people are entitled to. Everyone is entitled to poetry.
Some of the most profound moments I've had participating in this art form is not being on the stage itself. It's the connection with the audience members when they come up to you and say, oh my gosh, thank you so much for writing that poem, because you know, it connected with me in this way. And building those relationships and starting that conversation, I think, is one of the greatest strengths of this art form.
I always get really nervous before going up on stage. But once I'm up on stage, it's like this euphoria that happens where I'm like, that's when at any moment I can feel like, oh, I'm supposed to be doing this, or I should be doing this, or I'm not in the moment. But if I'm on stage, it's this moment of radical presence where I have to be in that moment if I want to perform well. And it's just a matter of existing in the place you're in with the people you're speaking to, and understanding that they all have their own experiences too. It's this huge revelation of community and of human individuality.
Let me hand over my soul without splinters. Lock fingers and hold the reaper's hand before he grows too grim.
Give me a funeral for the living, a death with dignity surrounded by those I love.
How blessed the countdown of heartbeats to single digits, the sacrament of hearing goodbye,
a gentle exhale of body.
A relief.
There are enough people in this art who love it so much, even though they despise it sometimes, because it's a game. We've turned art into a game. Very much so. But it still is really about the people in that art and not about the way that you play the game.
Please welcome Beans J.
Eric Harris, Dylan Klebold, Adam Lanza. Pulled my trigger looking for peace. but I am not a peacekeeper. I'm a manifestation of fear, hate, and anger. Grim Reaper, I am a gun. You take me to school. Cross the line from your waistline, pull me from the trenches of your trench coat. My gun smoke unloads Columbine reenactments, Virginia Tech copycats. Your actions will be hooked in the sands of time. Your name will ring bells in the hallways, adding on to the list of kids pushed too far. I can stop you from being bullied. Can you see that my results?
I didn't know people could speak with such authority about social issues. I had never seen people take the stage with regularity and you just go in really hard. You say the things that people are afraid to say. You call yourself out on what you have done. You write about it, then you tell people about it. And I think the value when it comes to social issue change and justice and is giving, quite honestly, giving anybody who needs the microphone, and then amplifying it out to an audience, amplifying it out through the speakers, because there are issues that nobody will talk about until they're on that microphone, until they're given a choice, until they're given a chance. And I really do think that SLAM, I'm really excited to go to Nationals to hear the stories from other parts of the country that I don't know about yet. And I think that's SLAM's power.
When you get people in a room whose sole purpose is just to listen and have open ears to whatever is going to be said on stage. I mean, I've had people say, you know, I disagree with you, but I'm glad you said what you said.
And that's where the power of slam poetry comes in for me. If I can acknowledge that the problem is actually out there and then get one or two or three or maybe even 10 other people to acknowledge that the problem actually exists, then we can actually start doing something to get something done with that problem.
The most important thing about slam poetry is the listening. You know, because I can write about, you know, in whatever injustice until I'm blue in the face, but ultimately, like, I'm a middle-class white woman. Like, I've got a lot of privilege.
Yeah.
But listening to the stories of folks who are at the intersection of different identities, who are writing about their experiences, they bring to it the depth and the validity.
100 feet away from each other, I hate to fear the worst when I see a black man.
I hate to fear the worst when I see a white woman.
But passing you on abandoned streets is the nightmare I've been taught to have. All catcalls and wolf whistles, all thug and aggressive. These streets spell assault for me.
All accusations, dispatching police. They shoot first, ask questions later. These streets are death row for me.
When I see your color is violent tendencies.
My baggy jeans is hiding something.
Your walk toward me is predatory.
My skin is motive enough to lead me to your slaughterhouse of assumptions. When you see me as anything other than
police process meat, making sure the morgue stays fed.
I lower my head to prevent suspicion like I have been taught.
I carry my keys like claws to defend my body like I've been trained. I'm
just
trying
to get home safely.
I guess my goal is always to try and be more vulnerable, and it can be hard because people, I mean, anyone who's seen my poetry know things about me that, like, not everyone would on the street, you know, and I just have to be comfortable with sharing that with rooms full of people that I don't know, and I don't know, like, how they could use that information or how they would interpret it or how they would interpret me. But I have to just be okay with continuously, like, pulling apart these layers between us and all these walls to just be like, hey, this is who I am. It might be who you are too. Like, we might be exactly the same in this way. And maybe I'm speaking directly to you. I try and read my words like I'm speaking directly to every individual in the audience.
After a heated conversation about Ferguson with my parents, after recounting the words of black mothers, black fathers, black poets about the heartbreak, the fear, after telling my parents about parents like them who are afraid to raise their children under the jowls of police dogs, my dad ends the conversation with, "Well, Nicole, America isn't the worst place they could live in. Lately, I've been thinking about America. I've been thinking about my childhood, sitting on the lawn on the 4th of July, watching Fireworks go off in the distance. Fireworks are simple things. Gunpowder in a canister igniting, creating a loud bang. A star-shaped hole in a black sky. Guns operate in much the same way. I want this to be what I think of when I think of America.
I think when a person is brave enough to stand up in front of a group and talk about a topic that is important to them, they are giving everyone else in that group and everyone else who can hear permission to also say or also express or join the conversation. People start putting their true selves out there. All of a sudden, everyone's like, well, here's my true self. And you know what? Maybe we're not that different. And like, here are the areas we're different and let's talk about it.
If you've put everything that you need to into that poem, and for a while after you're done, you don't have much left. And then if you get the reaction you want, that's kind of like a recharge. It's like, yes, I have put this out and I have received back, you know, so you don't come back empty. It doesn't happen perfectly all the time, but the times that it does are just magical. And that's why you keep coming back, because it's kind of this like addictive, intoxicating experience. I don't know where I'm gonna go from here, but I wanna make art that matters. I wanna, you know, touch people with the words that I'm putting together. So however that looks.
I devote most of my time to this. Except for a few other arts related skills, you know, this is what I do. And if I could do this, and I don't just mean, you know, just going up on stage and performing, I also mean like empowering others to do the same and working to take all the silence in the world, that really loud silence, and just break it in half and let everything out from everyone who needs to let it out. The hope being more people will find this world bearable.
The Hear Hear Group poetry team took third place in their first preliminary round performance and second place in their second round performance at the National Poetry Slam in Oakland. Mallory Everhart will go on to represent the team at the individual World Poetry Slam Championships this October in Washington. Hear Hear hosts an open mic potluck the first Saturday of every month and a poetry slam every third Wednesday. Everyone is welcome.
That was Big Something intern Charlie Neves speaking with Nico Wilkinson, Cameron Eckmeyer, Jermard Beasley, Andrew Ziegler, and Mallory Everhart, members of the Hear Hear poetry team, which competed at the National Poetry Slam in Oakland earlier this month. All the performances you heard in that piece were recorded at the 2015 Poetry Slam Team Send-Off Show at the Tim Gill Center for Public Media here in Colorado Springs. To listen to that piece again, and for more information on Hear Hear, head to krcc.org. The Big Something is produced by Noel Black and me, Jake Brownell, for KRCC in Colorado Springs. Special thanks to KRCC News Director Andrea Chalfin, State House Reporter Benta Berklin, and Big Something intern Charlie Neves. You can listen again to this episode and learn more about today's guests at krcc.org. The Big Something is part of KRCC Presents, a new weekly showcase of locally produced content right here on KRCC.